cost and more to do with the perceived value on the part of the user. What is a network effect? It's when the value per user rises as the total number of users rises. So let's think for a moment about buying a refrigerator. Does the value to me of a particular brand of refrigerator, is it at all dependent on whether lots of other people buy that particular brand of refrigerator? The answer is largely not, right? The value to each user of that particular refrigerator is independent of how many people use that refrigerator. But now let's think about some other products and services. Let's think about eBay, LinkedIn, video games, Google, eHarmony, or Amazon. In each of these cases, the users of those products and services find that the value to each user rises as the number of users increases. Let's see if we can explain this with regard to eBay, because some may not understand quite why and how that works. eBay, of course, the online auction marketplace that has come to be very, very successful since the mid-1990s. Well, what is the value to each user of eBay? Well, let's think about a new online auction marketplace that was to come to be. Suppose an entrepreneur launched an online auction marketplace to compete with eBay. What would the value be to each user? Well, in the early days, with very few users, there'd be very little value to each customer. Why? Because each customer would look and say, this is only valuable to me if there are many other people with whom I can buy and sell goods. Without many other people with whom I can interact, this service, as pretty as the website may be and as cool as the branding campaign may be, this service isn't really valuable to me. But eBay, this is valuable to me. There's great value. Why? Because I can go on that site and find many other buyers and sellers. If I have an item that I'm looking to sell, there'll be lots of interested parties out there with whom I can transact. And hopefully, I can get a good price as a result. If I'm looking to buy, I'm hoping there's many sellers offering the same good, and I can look for the best price. So there's value to me as more users enter the network. This is also true with LinkedIn and other social media platforms. LinkedIn is a professional networking platform, social media platform for professionals in a variety of fields, including business. What's the value to me of using LinkedIn? Well, it rises significantly as many other colleagues in different institutions join the LinkedIn network. Because now I have people with whom I can share ideas, with whom I can network, with whom I can look for jobs, etc. Google, what's the network effect in the search business? Well, the more people that use Google, the more Google is able to refine its search algorithms. The more it learns and becomes smarter about being able to predict what each of us wants when we go to the site and try to search. So the more people that use the site, the smarter Google becomes, the more value to each of us of the site. And what about Amazon? Where is the network effect there? Well, many people go to Amazon and they review products that they've purchased. It began, of course, with their famous book reviews, but now there are reviews for a whole array of items that Amazon offers on its site. Well, the more people that go to Amazon, the more people review products and services, the more value to me of using Amazon as a service to buy goods. Why? Because more others using the site means more reviews, means more information for me as I try to decide which brand of that particular item that I'd like to purchase. So in each of these examples, the value to each user rises as more users come on board. Why then does this phenomenon lead to first mover advantage? Well, because presumably the first mover can gather lots of users, and as such, they can increase their value to each user. And that creates an advantage over the upstart who comes in with no users and has very little value to offer. So many of these new economy firms, many internet firms, who are in businesses where network effects exist, have pursued the so-called get big fast strategy. Get a lot of users to create that higher value per user. Ultimately, we'll find out how to make money later. Right now, let's build the network effect as a defense against others who choose to come in and try to compete with us. And this has been a powerful, powerful phenomenon with firms like Facebook or LinkedIn, with companies like eBay and Amazon. In markets with these network effects, you should note that typically there are high switching costs for users. And when switching costs are high, users encounter a lock-in effect. They're in effect stuck with a particular good or service or platform. From the perspective of the user, that may not be ideal. But from the perspective of a company offering a product or service, switching costs are a wonderful thing. You'd like your customer to be locked into you. Why are customers locked in to a firm like LinkedIn? Well, let's think about that for a moment. Are there high switching costs if you were to switch to another platform for professional networking? Well, of course there are, because if I switch, but none of my colleagues at my firm and other firms switch, well, then what value is there to me of this new platform? So I have to be able to get all of my colleagues to switch as well. That's difficult. And recreating my new network, all those contacts, all those interconnections on a new platform, that's going to be very difficult. That's going to be time consuming. That's going to be inefficient. So the switching costs are high. It keeps me locked in to a firm like LinkedIn. And that's true with a number of platforms where network effects exist. What are the sources of these switching costs? Well, there are many sources. Let me just touch on a couple. First, if there are any durable purchases, if there's any equipment you must buy to use a particular product or service, that locks you in. So in the video game case, you buy a console to play a particular set of games. That console, whether it's the PlayStation or the Xbox, that's a durable purchase, and now that's locked you in to buying video games from that same company or its partners. Brand-specific training can be a source of lock-in. If you've had to do some training so that you know a particular service or a platform, and that, of course, creates switching costs. If there's specialized suppliers, that may also create switching costs. Or contractual commitments that you've had to make. Loyalty programs can create switching costs as well. If you have something where you've been rewarded for your loyalty, and you will continue to be, you may be reluctant to switch. All of these issues create lock-in and make it good for companies as they try to retain their customers. So, in some of these markets where strong network effects exist, not only is there a first mover advantage, but that first mover can come to be the dominant technology or firm. They can become the so-called standard in that market. We see that in certain cases, right? Microsoft with Windows becoming a dominant player with 90% market share in the operating system business. So not only did the network effects enable them to have first mover advantage, but they became the standard, almost completely dominating the market. But that's not always the case. Why is that? Because in certain products or services, while there may be strong network effects, there's also high demand for variety on the part of the customer. The customer doesn't want only one solution. And so one dominant standard doesn't come to prevail, but several standards come to coexist. So let's take video games. In video games, there are strong network effects, right? There is value to me if other people use the Sony PlayStation. I can share games with them. I can perhaps rent games more easily. I know that if others use the platform, then developers are more likely to build cool games for that platform. So there's definitely more value to me if more people use the same platform I'm using. Network effects exist. But there's also high demand for variety. There's a wide array of people who play video games, from the casual gamer, the young children, to the hardcore gamer in their 20s, who's perhaps, you know, the male living in their mother's basement playing video games. There are lots of different people with different tastes and preferences playing. And as a result, despite strong network effects, one player hasn't come to dominate the market. And right now we're looking at three players who coexist: Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo with its Wii family of products. So sometimes we see a dominant standard, but if there's high demand for variety and a really heterogeneous customer base, we may see multiple firms come to coexist, and the first mover alone doesn't win. Now this leads me to a really important point. Can we identify some characteristics of situations when first movers definitely have the advantage and others were perhaps not so much? Well, one framework has looked at the fact that market evolution and technological evolution, the speed at which both the market evolves and technology evolves, that has a great bearing on whether we'll see a standard or a dominant player who moved first see enduring advantage. So let's take a market where we've seen fairly slow evolution of both technology and the market itself, like Scotch tape, right? 3M creates a product, Scotch tape. very, very slow moving space where they've been able to achieve first mover advantage and it's endured. But in the personal computer business, where we've seen rapid technological obsolescence and lots of dynamic changes over time, much harder for someone to establish and maintain a first mover advantage. And this is really key. The notion that first movers don't always win, that the conventional wisdom is not correct, that there's a real downside to first mover advantage. Well, why? First and most importantly, there are high costs, in some cases, of blazing a new trail technologically. Some people call these pioneering costs. What does that mean? It means sometimes moving into an entirely new category with a product customers don't know anything about. Well, there's a lot of uncertainty there. There's a lot of education of the consumer that needs to take place. There's a lot of change that will happen early in that technology's existence. And so moving first can have its disadvantages because those fast followers, the people who come in second and third, they can watch the mistakes you've made. They can learn from those and they can catapult beyond you. They can take advantage of the fact that you've blazed the trail and then move quickly to supersede you. There's also a problem though that you make certain commitments when you move first. Those commitments, as we've noted, can become rigid and it can become hard for you to change. If you've had success as a first mover initially, you can become complacent or experience organizational inertia and not be able to change as the market begins to evolve. And finally, there's the sunk cost trap. The bottom line is you begin to invest in a particular technology, in a particular way of doing business. You are the first mover. And now even if you start to get negative feedback, you can't cut your losses and shift strategy. Instead, you're beholden to what you've already invested. And you throw good money after bad. You become overcommitted to your initial course of action because of all the emotion and the money and the effort you've put into it. That sunk cost trap definitely inhibits many first movers from adapting as markets evolve. And it's why second movers come in and supersede them in many cases. Pioneering a new category can be expensive. And it's really interesting to watch how second movers, often large firms, but are agile enough, they have money, they have resources, but they have agility, they can come in and pass you by. There's a great quote from Greg Carpenter, who's a researcher in this field who's shown that second movers often do better than first movers. He said a lot of times, pioneers are not very well funded. They create a competitive game, and then they're unable to dominate it. Their resources are just too limited. So competitors enter quickly, and with more resources, are able to win the game that the pioneer has created. We see this in many situations, right? Where eToys comes in, they're an entrepreneurial upstart, they see the future, they know retailing on the web is going to be a dominant trend, but they don't really have the resources, they don't have it all figured out, so they pioneer the way, but then others pass them by. Well, when should you pioneer? When is it that that may be the right strategy? Well, if the expected life of a product category is very short, then being first may be important because if there's only a short time window, let's take advantage of it. If the value of the product is highly subjective or intangible, it may be important to be the first mover, right? If brand matters a lot and establishing that brand because the product is somewhat intangible and its perceived value is very subjective. And finally, if the cost of imitation is high, why might it be high? Well, if there's patents or other barriers that second movers will face, if you can protect intellectual property, then the cost of imitating will be high. And so being first can have tremendous advantage. And maybe then you should pioneer. But first movers don't always win. And in part, it's because they overestimate the importance of economies of scale, learning curves, and network effects. All those things that are sources of first mover advantage, sometimes we over-attribute success to those sources of advantage. We rely on them too much, and therefore we think that being first will lead to great performance and sustainable advantage. Let's think about economies of scale for a moment. I would argue that managers often grossly overestimate the economies of scale in a business. Why? Well, costs per unit certainly do fall over time as volume increases in many businesses, whether it's automobile manufacturing or the logistics business at FedEx and others. But at some point, that curve begins to rise again. In other words, the cost per unit eventually start to rise again as you get too big too complex, too bureaucratic. There is some point where bigger is no longer better, where eventually you've grown your organization to a point where there's some inefficiency that begins to be built in, and where smaller firms now have the advantage over you. Why do firms overestimate economies of scale? In many cases, they believe bigger is better because that has been true up to a point. So they believe it will continue to be true, and they don't see the limits of those economies. They don't see where it will begin to turn negative for them. If we look at General Motors in the automobile business, scale was a tremendous advantage for them for much of the 20th century. But eventually, they became so big, so bureaucratic, so complex to manage, that it became a liability. They became vulnerable because they weren't as flexible and nimble as other firms. Leaders like to lead large firms, right? They believe in the power of big if they're the incumbent player. And they don't realize sometimes the liabilities, the disadvantages they have relative to the upstart and the entrepreneur. Learning curves have an issue as well that we have to consider, right? Learning curves can be a tremendous source of advantage. But what happens if we're in a situation where we can't hold all that learning tight, where we can't protect our intellectual property? Scholars call these spillover effects. What if the learning that we're achieving through experience, through being in the marketplace for some period of time and having produced it, we've become better and better at producing it over time? What if that learning spills out beyond the boundaries of our firm? And if that's the case, then being first no longer is as much of an advantage. The second mover can capture those spillovers, can learn from us, including from our mistakes, and pass us. This issue is particularly problematic in economies without strong intellectual property protection. So in Asia, in China, for example, where we don't have those laws that are able to protect the intellectual property, or if we're in situations where labor is very mobile and knowledge that's being created is not the type you can easily protect through patents, think Silicon Valley, for example. In these situations where we can't protect and hold proprietary what we've learned, the learning curve no longer becomes a source of first mover advantage. Now the second mover can grab that labor that's mobile, can grab that knowledge that can't be patented, or perhaps can even grab knowledge that's patentable because there aren't strong intellectual property protections built into the law. In each of those cases, the learning curve no longer conveys first mover advantage as much as it does in some cases where you can protect your intellectual property. You can keep learning proprietary. How about network effects? Surely that's the one where if they exist, it will always make sense to be first and to get in fast. Well, maybe not. I mean, let's think about social media, for example. If network effects are so crucial in that business, then how come Facebook came along and not only did it supplant early movers like Friendster, but it overwhelmed a company like MySpace as well. So even in a case where the network effect exists and where lots of entrepreneurs believing these network effects exist are pursuing get-big-fast strategies, is it right? Are they correct? Well, Mieszek Piskorski is a scholar who's looked at social media platforms in great detail. And he's looked and said sometimes there are certain networks where the customer actually prefers a non-crowded network. They don't want too many other users on the site. They want more users. There's value as others use the site. But as too many people use the site, the value starts to turn negative again. The example he gives is eHarmony. He says, you know, we want to be on a dating platform where there are lots of others who post on the platform. We want a variety of other potential partners, but we don't want too many because eventually we run into competition. We want to date a certain person, but too many others want to date that person as well, and some of them may be more attractive to that other individual than we are. And so there's some limits to how many other users sometimes we want. Felix Oberholzer-Gee at Harvard has also looked at this issue of might there be some downsides to the network effect? And he looked at why and how Friendster failed in social media and why Facebook survived. He said Friendster pursued a first-come, first-served strategy, trying to get big fast. They pursued customers around the world in both Asia and North America. But he said there was an interesting problem. The Asian users generally didn't really care much about being on the same network and interacting with U.S. users and vice versa. So spending all the money to build two giant sets of individuals on the network in two different continents didn't actually add a lot of value. They might have done better if they just focused on building the network within one region than trying to expend all those resources to getting big fast across two regions. And that waste of resources made them vulnerable to others who came in and built a better platform with more focus in their strategy. Who was more focused? Facebook was. What did they do? Not only did Facebook focus on one region, but they also focused initially on one customer segment. How did Facebook begin? They began with someone at Harvard who took the physical Facebook that had pictures and backgrounds on all of the members of the first year class and putting that up on the web. And they began then, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder, began then creating this network for college students, people who had an email address that ended in EDU. This focus created network effects, but in a bounded way. And Guy, in his scholarship on Friendster and its demise, has argued that indiscriminate growth often undermines the very network effects you're trying to achieve. And he would argue that's what happened at a firm like Friendster. The more focused strategy, still creating value as more users join Facebook, but with some boundaries, was more successful. Are there lower switching costs today? Might there be less first mover advantage today than there was several decades ago in business? This is an interesting question that's been asked recently. You know, as we see, incumbents get toppled much more readily, and firms face much shorter periods of time during which they're able to achieve advantage and hold on to it. Some have begun to ask, maybe it's just easier today to switch to a new rival, to a new upstart, and therefore first mover advantage is not as crucial, not as enduring as it once was. And this is some interesting scholarship by Ayal and Chowdhury, where they've argued that as we've moved to things like LinkedIn, where we can move our contacts very easily, where we can log in with universal logins and sign-ons across multiple platforms, as we begin to do this, what's happened is we're not as locked in. We can port our contacts from one platform to the other. We can move en masse with our friends from one platform to the other. We can have one profile that we can now use to log into multiple networks. As all of that's happened, we're facing a situation where it's easier to switch for customers, and we're not as locked in. And therefore, first movers have less of an advantage. Now, interestingly, one strategy for dealing with situations where network effects exist and where firms are trying to achieve first mover advantage, one strategy for that is what's been described as the freemium business model. Some firms give away their products for free, and then they have a premium offering for which people can pay. LinkedIn does this, for example. When does that make sense? Well, it makes sense if there are strong network effects. You're trying to build your network as fast as you can, but it only makes sense if also we know that there are low marginal costs for adding new users. If we can add new users without a lot of additional expense, then getting big fast and getting a lot of free people on the site and then trying to offer premium services, that makes sense. But if there are high marginal costs of adding new users, then you can cost yourself a lot of money and you can get deep in the red and perhaps even go bankrupt trying to get big fast. So freemium can be an effective strategy, but only if there are low marginal costs for adding new users coupled with those strong network effects. The lessons then. Think carefully about the pluses and minuses of pioneering versus being a fast follower. Understand the sources of first mover advantage and the limitations of those advantages. As an entrant or a follower, exploit the weaknesses in a pioneer's first mover status. In short, don't buy the conventional wisdom. Being first, being early, is not always as advantageous as we think it is. So now your assignment. Consider Boeing. Think about Boeing, one of the leaders in airplane manufacturing, and ask yourself, why did the firm have such powerful first mover advantage with regard to the jumbo jet business? What is it? What were the sources of advantage they had by being first? And then contrast that with personal digital assistants. Why were the early movers in the 1980s, early 90s, such as Apple's Newton product, why were they not successful? What happened that caused the first movers there not to have enduring advantage over time?
This lecture is titled, When Netflix Met Blockbuster.
Let's go back to 1999 and take a look at a retail chain called Blockbuster. You remember them. selling videos, rentals, to Americans. Who was the Blockbuster mainstream customer in 1999? They were a 30 to 45-year-old mom, so-called soccer mom, living in the suburbs, husband, two kids, and a dog, driving a minivan or an SUV, renting VHS tapes at the time, coming to Blockbuster on a Friday or Saturday night, stopping for takeout at the same strip mall or a nearby one as the Blockbuster store. And they were looking for new releases, recent hits that had just come to the store, having been in the theaters several months earlier. Now contrast that with the original Netflix customer. In 1999, Netflix began offering its service to Americans. Who was that original Netflix customer? Were they the same as the mainstream Blockbuster customer? They were not. They tended to be an 18 to 29-year-old male. Where were they living? Many of them in their mother's basement or dorm room. They weren't renting VHS tapes. They were trying out a new technology called DVDs. Were they watching on a flat-screen television? No, they couldn't afford one. They were watching DVDs on a computer, often on a laptop. And they weren't always renting new releases. What were they watching? Old cult classics, independent films, and tried-and-true films like Caddyshack and Star Wars, Monty Python movies, and The Godfather. They weren't necessarily simply watching new releases, as the families often did when mom brought home the latest and greatest hit that had been in theaters just a few months earlier. Now, what's interesting about this is to think about Blockbuster's market research at the time in 1999. They were conducting focus groups and surveys with their mainstream customer. They were asking that soccer mom what she liked and disliked about Blockbuster. And what was her main criticism of Blockbuster stores? She wanted more copies of hit movies. Why? Well, she could recall those instances where little Sally, her 6-year-old, had cried all the way home because Blockbuster didn't have any more copies of Finding Nemo. And the store had had posters for weeks saying that on May 1st, Finding Nemo would be hitting the stores and available for rental. So, what did Blockbuster do? They had to offer more copies. So they began to offer their guarantee that they would have available the movies that were just hitting their stores. And so they went from one area, small area of new releases, to an entire wall of new releases in the store. Soon it was multiple walls of the store, the entire perimeter lined with the new releases, sometimes with 50, 60, 70 copies of a particular movie. Well, who's getting more disenchanted with Blockbuster as this is going on? The mom's happy because now little Sally's not crying. But the 18 to 29-year-old male, they're really upset. Now they can't find Caddyshack. Not because some other young man has rented it, but because Caddyshack is no longer available at any Blockbuster store. There's no more room on the shelves for certain old movies because new releases have crowded them out. What's the young male's other big complaint about Blockbuster? Late fees. You remember those. If you didn't return your movie within 48 hours, they whacked you with a fee, sometimes equal to the amount you paid to rent the movie. Why did the young male hate late fees? He didn't have much money. He was an irresponsible young male who wanted to watch the movie 10 times, never leave his basement, and who always forgot to return the movies when they were due. He wanted to watch that movie often. That was key. That was key. He hated the late fees. Now, what's a lesson from this story? Lesson from this story is that Blockbuster was pursuing what we call incremental innovation. They were talking to their customer and offering small improvements in their service, in their in-store experience, in the availability of movies. But along came Netflix with what we call a disruptive innovation, a fundamentally different product and service, in fact, a whole new business model, and it undermined Blockbuster's competitive advantage. Recall that we talked about the main threats to competitive advantage. We said there were three main external threats to competitive advantage. The first was imitation. When someone does what you're doing, but finds a way to do it better. Then there was substitution, where someone comes along with an alternative product or service that fulfills the same human need. And finally, there was holdup, when either your buyers or your suppliers gain leverage over you and begin to extract more of the profit from the value chain. In many ways, the most serious threat is substitution. And that's what we're seeing here with Netflix, offering really a substitute to the traditional brick-and-mortar store that rented movies to customers. Why is the most serious threat substitution in many cases? It's because it's so hard to foresee, and perhaps it's even harder to respond to, as we will see with Blockbuster. You know, Joseph Schumpeter, the great economist, wrote many years ago about the need to look beyond your direct rivals when thinking about the principal threat to your competitive advantage. He said it is still competition within a rigid pattern of invariant conditions, methods of production, and forms of industrial organization that practically monopolizes attention. But in capitalist reality, as distinct from its textbook picture, it's not that kind of competition which counts, but the competition from the new commodity, new technology, new type of organization. This kind of competition is much more effective than the other, as a bombardment is in comparison with forcing the door. Schumpeter was telling us that, in fact, this threat of substitution comes out of left field and often poses the most serious threat. We have a classic study of this idea of disruptive innovation. In fact, the author who coined this term was a man named Clay Christensen. Clay Christensen had been in the business world for many years and then returned to Harvard Business School to pursue his doctorate in the early 1990s. And he conducted a study for his dissertation on the disk drive industry. And he traced the evolution of that industry from 1976 through 1992, watching as a series of technological innovations came to market and observing what happened to the players in that market. From a technological perspective, the physical size of the disk drive shrank dramatically during that time. Moreover, the cost per megabyte of storage dropped substantially. Well, that was happening from a technology standpoint. What happened in the market? Well, he observed that the incumbent leaders in one generation of technology often were not able to maintain their leadership in the next technological generation. So we saw a new player emerge as the leader in each subsequent evolution of disk drive technology. Now, why was that? What was going on? Well, Christensen argued that the incumbent players were intent on pursuing what he called sustaining or incremental innovation, minor improvements to the attributes that mainstream customers valued. They were doing their market research, listening to those small changes that might enhance customer satisfaction, and implementing them. But what about those disruptive innovators, the people who entered the market and supplanted those leaders? The disruptive innovation was something very different. These innovators were introducing a quite different package of attributes from the ones that mainstream customers typically valued. They often performed significantly worse on certain attributes that the mainstream customers valued a lot. But their performance trajectory was steep for these disruptive innovations. Think about this in terms of Netflix, right? They weren't focused on the attributes that Blockbuster was focused on. They had no stores, so in-store experience, availability of new releases, these were not things they focused on. They performed significantly worse, in fact, on new release availability. Netflix didn't want to be in the new release business. They, in fact, were intent on being in the business of renting older movies. But for doing that, for renting older movies, they came up with an entire new way of doing business. And they performed, initially not so well, but they were on that steep trajectory, improving at a rapid rate. And while Blockbuster took a while to respond, by the time they did respond, Netflix had improved considerably and now was a formidable competitor. Well, you might wonder, why do incumbent firms struggle so much? Why did Blockbuster struggle? Why did the incumbent players in the disk drive industry struggle so much to respond to this disruptive innovation? We'll start with two main reasons that Christensen and his co-author Joseph Bauer articulated in an article in the mid-1990s based on this research. They looked to traditional market research and traditional resource allocation processes within the incumbent firms as sources of the problem. Let's take a look at this. First, traditional market research. Every marketing guru tells companies, you must listen to your customers. You must be more customer-centric. Put the customer first. The customer is boss, you hear. But when you ask the customer about your product or service, what type of feedback do you receive? The customer, it turns out, thinks mostly in terms of incremental improvement, the minor adjustments you might make to make them more satisfied, to make them happier. They don't think in terms of totally new ways of doing business. The customer can't see the future in that way in many cases. You know, Steve Jobs said, you don't invent the iPod through a focus group. Steven Spielberg said, you don't come out with a groundbreaking new movie by focus group. So talking to customers is important, but it tends to be good at incremental innovation and not so much at helping you foresee disruptive innovation. But there's another piece that's important here, and that has to do with resource allocation processes. What do we mean by a resource allocation process? Well, every firm has to have some way of deciding how to allocate scarce investment dollars. So they have to have some way of assessing requests for major capital investments. And how do they do that? Well, incumbent firms tend to have rigorous financial practices for doing so. What do they ask for when someone has an idea? They ask for a model. They ask for an estimate of the return on investment. And employees will use financial techniques like discounted cash flow or cost-benefit analysis, ROI techniques, other things to try to understand whether it makes economic sense to pursue this new idea. But think about it for a moment. If you've got an idea that's really out of left field, that's totally new, that's a cutting-edge technology, can you actually do a very sophisticated financial analysis? To do so, you'd have to be able to, with precision, estimate the revenues that you will generate, the size of the market opportunity, the costs of bringing that product or service to market. In a really bleeding-edge technological situation, it's going to be very hard to come up with that kind of precise financial model. So there's a bias built in at incumbent firms. That bias is built in, and it tends to lead to the funding of incremental innovation. Because an incremental innovation is one that's building just as a minor addition off of the existing product or service. As a result, you can be much more precise in estimating the new revenues you generate or the cost savings that you will produce by implementing this sustaining innovation. So big firms tend to shuttle their resources toward people who can make a good financial case. And the incremental innovators, well, they can make their case much more effectively than the bleeding edge technological leaders who come in there and have to say, I don't know a lot when trying to represent their cost-benefit analysis. Big firms don't want to hear, I don't know. They don't want to hear, it's uncertain. They want to hear, this is what the benefits and costs will be. And so there's a bias to incremental innovation. There's also a fear of big firms that, well, this new product or service may cannibalize our existing product or service. If we move online at Blockbuster, well, that will take traffic away from our stores. We'll kill the golden goose. We can't do that. So big firms worry about that. They don't want to take revenue away from a product or a service that's been so successful and that's profitable in hopes that this new idea could someday down the road become as profitable. But there's other reasons, you know, why incumbent firms struggle so much with disruptive innovation. Richard Foster was a longtime partner at McKinsey Consulting. He talked about the idea of mindset, and he said, you know, many large firms end up in a situation of what he called mental lock-in. They get stuck in a particular mental model of how you make money in a particular business. And the problem, he said, is disruptive technologies, well, they not only have a different set of product attributes that they're bringing to market, sometimes they have a fundamentally different business model. And the incumbent firm can't wrap their heads around that new business model because they're so used to making money in a certain way. Let's take a look at an example of that. You all remember that at one point in time, Polaroid was a dominant brand in the world in the field of instant photography. They were a longtime leader, not only with a great product, but it was backed by great science and manufacturing and distribution capabilities. Polaroid was built around a deeply held business model, razors and blades, something that we've talked about. The idea that you got people the camera, you sold it to them at cost, maybe even at a loss. Why? Because once they had that Polaroid camera, they had to buy film, the so-called blades. And they had to buy that film for many years to come. So Polaroid did not make its money on the hardware, on the camera. They made all their money on the film. And it was incredibly lucrative. Now, the story that many have heard is that they simply failed to see the digital revolution, that they were caught completely off guard, and they never realized the world was going to move to digital. That's actually not the reality. A case study by Tripsis and Gavetti looks in detail at what happened with the demise of Polaroid. They found that, in fact, substantial research and development activity was taking place, going all the way back to the 1980s, in the Polaroid labs. They were working on digital technology, but they were very late coming to market with that technology. Why was that? Was it the scientists' fault? Did they not see the future? Tripsis and Gavetti conclude that it was not. They find, in fact, that there was strong resistance from senior management, who did not want to advance the project, did not want to give this new technology, digital cameras, the resources needed to go to market. They were hesitant. Why? They were wedded to an old business model. Let me see if I can explain that. In Tripsis and Gavetti's research, they interviewed someone who worked in the labs on the research and development with regard to digital cameras. And he said at one point, the catch to our product concept was that you had to be in the hardware business to make money. How could you say that? Where's the film? There's no film. So what we had was a constant fight with the senior executive management in Polaroid for 5 years. In other words, what he was saying was the razors and blades model didn't fit with regard to digital technology. Now, there was no film. So now you had to make money off the hardware. You had to generate a strong profit margin from selling the digital camera with no profit to come from the blades, from the film. Well, that new business model didn't fit at all with the way Polaroid had operated for years. And management was stuck. They had a mental lock-in phenomenon taking place. And they couldn't adapt quickly enough, and they didn't allocate the resources to people working on that new technology in their very own research and development laboratories. Netflix, too, was bringing a different business model, not just a different product or service, to market. And here, their business model was dependent on something that Chris Anderson, the former editor of Wired magazine, called the long tail in a great book that he published several years ago. What's the long tail and how does it work? And why was it so different than the traditional blockbuster model? Well, in Anderson's book published several years ago, he took a look at the time the largest brick and mortar music retailer in the United States. That was Walmart. And he looked and he said he noticed that they carried about 4,500 unique CD titles or about 55,000 songs. Moreover, most of the activity in the Walmart store in their music section was about the hits. The top 200 albums accounted for 90% of Walmart's music sales at any given point in time. Thus, roughly 5% of the albums on the shelves accounted for 90% of their revenue. Walmart's music business exhibited the usual pattern found in hit-driven businesses before the internet. We see this in books, in movies, in music, entertainment. Businesses in general were hit-driven at the time. But he noticed something rather different when you looked at some of the new emerging technologies of entertainment. He took a look at Rhapsody, a digital music service. They carried more than 1.5 million songs, many, many times greater than the number of songs available at a Walmart store. Moreover, a big chunk of the sales, yes, they were accounted for by the hit songs. The most popular songs definitely drove a big portion of Rhapsody's volume. But Rhapsody also reported that songs ranked as low as number 900,000 on their popularity charts were streamed at least once per quarter. Remember, Walmart only sold 55,000 songs at the time in their stores. Here was Rhapsody, a digital music service, selling many, many more songs, having a huge library available to them. Anderson looked at several different sort of new economy firms and noticed the same phenomenon. At Netflix, 21% of their revenue was generated from movies not available at Blockbuster. Rhapsody, 40% of its revenue generated from music not available in a Walmart store. Amazon, 25% of its revenue in the book business generated from books not available in any Barnes & Noble brick and mortar store. The long tail. The idea then that you could generate a lot of revenue from products that were low in popularity, so low that they weren't carried in any of your brick and mortar competitors. Well, this was an interesting phenomenon, a whole new possibility for how to make money. And Netflix was capitalizing it. In fact, they didn't want to be in the new release business because that's a difficult business. Yes, you make a lot of money when Finding Nemo first hits the store. But if you need many, many copies in order to please all those soccer moms, what do you do a month later when everyone's watched Finding Nemo? You don't need those copies anymore, and so you have to dump them. you start selling used movies in Blockbuster stores, trying to capture as much revenue as possible from all this excess inventory. Netflix, they didn't want to be in that business. They wanted to be in the long tail. They wanted to sell less popular movies, but movies that were cheap to acquire and that they could hold in a few distribution centers around the country and then ship at the customer's request. What a better model that they could operate if they could avoid having to keep all of that inventory that would soon be obsolete the way it was in Blockbuster stores. So Chris Anderson wrote that traditional retailers made all their money in these entertainment businesses off of the hits, the top 100 or 200 songs or books or movies at any given point in time. Hybrid retailers, people who operated catalogs or online sites, still selling physical goods but not distributing them through brick-and-mortar stores, they could make money off of many more items because they could stock many more items in a distribution center than Walmart or Barnes & Noble could stock in a physical store. But then he said the purely digital retailers, they can make money forever, no matter how low in popularity an item is, because the marginal cost of adding another song to the iTunes or Spotify library was so low, virtually zero, you could make any song available even if there was only one customer out there who wanted that song. Purely digital retailers could make money on a wide, wide array of products in a way brick-and-mortar retailers simply could not. And Netflix, as they moved to streaming, they could do that. No longer were they simply a hybrid retailer offering physical products online. With the streaming revolution, they could offer any movie they wanted to any customer, and the cost of putting that movie up was very low in terms of that marginal cost of adding an additional movie. But what drove demand for these non-hits? How do you get people to rent a movie that's not a major hit in the theaters? How do you create demand from the customer? Well, you do it in a whole new way. What Anderson noted was the traditional way that you got people to go to the theaters to see Finding Nemo or rent it at a Blockbuster store, or the traditional way that you might get them to listen to a new song from Taylor Swift or Brad Paisley, well, you used mass marketing. But in this new world, Anderson said, now you saw social networking, customer reviews, playlists, blogs, other forms of social media, driving demand for niche products, products that you could never justify running a mass marketing campaign for. But now you could target and find the people who liked that particular genre, and you could offer them some new information via social media about that and get them to then come to your service and purchase it. But even beyond that, what Netflix did in bringing a new business model to the table was build algorithms, sophisticated statistical algorithms that used information they were collecting about the customer to create customized recommendations. So that when you logged on to the Netflix site, they would tell you, here's a movie you may never have heard of, but we think you will like, based on people like you, based on your history of renting movies, and based on the reviews you've performed and put up on our site about past movies you've viewed. Think about that. That's a whole new way of operating. Not going to the Blockbuster store and hoping that an associate might be able to offer a recommendation to you, but having personalized recommendations coming to your site all the time. Why couldn't Blockbuster replicate this when they finally went online many years later? Well, that was very, very difficult. By the time they moved to go online, several years after Netflix had already been there, they couldn't build those algorithms as easily. Netflix had been building this huge database for several years, and their predictive power of their statistical algorithms was quite high. Blockbuster now was playing catch-up. They didn't have that network effect going for them. Netflix's algorithms were getting better with each additional user. As more and more users used Netflix, there was more value to each new customer who could go there and say, wow, what a great personalized recommendation I've just received. Moreover, as Blockbuster eventually moved online, the customer they were trying to attract was initially the same customer they had catered to in their store, the soccer mom. But she was busy. She was much less likely to review movies or complete surveys as that young male living in his mother's basement. So they couldn't build algorithms as quickly and as effectively as Netflix had. A new business model upended the incumbent, not just a new product or service. So what should incumbent firms do? How should they react? Clay Christensen argued in his work on disruptive innovation that incumbent firms must separate a new unit trying to react to an upstart entrant. They have to create a separate subsidiary, wall them off from the mainstream business, and tell them to go after a new innovative opportunity in the market. Why? He argued that big companies eat their young, that it's very difficult. The mainstream unit will be so worried about protecting its profit margins and not seeing sales bleed off to this new innovation that they will essentially overwhelm this new idea. So separate it out. Protect it from the rest of the business and let them innovate. That was his argument. And he offered examples of this, like IBM, when they moved from the mainstream computer business to personal computers. They set up a separate business unit far away from their headquarters in New York and told them to go after this new opportunity. And at the time, it worked. Now, interestingly, there has been some criticism of these theories of disruptive innovation. In fact, just recently, in 2014, historian Jill Lepore wrote an article in The New Yorker, a harsh critique of Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation. It was a very harsh critique, even personal at times, and it received a lot of attention. But there was some validity. She critiqued some of the research methods and some of the applicability of the theory to a wide range of situations. She argued, in fact, that it had been applied in a wide range of industries, and perhaps it wasn't so widely applicable. Maybe you couldn't generalize quite as much as Christensen had done. What's my view on the critique? I think we have to be careful about this term disruptive innovation. We're hearing it all the time. It seems like it's in Fortune magazine and on the Wall Street Journal's pages every day. It's become something like a hammer, and we're looking for a nail to hammer in. It's an overused concept. Moreover, it's a very good descriptive tool. Looking back at a story like Netflix and Blockbuster, we can use the theory to explain Blockbuster's demise. But can we predict the future with the model? It's much more difficult to do. There's also this issue of two kinds of errors. You know, the error Christensen focuses on is the idea that incumbent firms sometimes miss the disruptive threat. They don't see it coming. But I think there's another kind of error that companies can make. They can make huge, misguided investments because they misperceive a threat. They begin to look at every new entrant as a potential disruptive innovator, and they start to throw huge dollars at lots of unproven technologies. That can be just as misguided as the blindness to a new idea that can happen when there's mental lock-in at an incumbent firm. You know, we have to be careful about the prescription that incumbent firms should separate units that are aiming to cope with a disruptive threat. I think that's the other thing that we have to be very careful about. You know, we talked about competitive advantage coming from an integrated system of activities. But if we separate out this new unit to go after a new idea, are we still going to have this integrated system of activities? Or will we have a disjointed firm? Will we have disconnects and not as powerful an advantage as a result? And we saw this, some of the misguided nature of this, with Netflix itself when it perceived streaming as the next disruptive threat that might undermine its mail business. And so it tried to separate itself into two firms, and customers revolted. It was a simplistic response to a much more complicated problem. Now, what was the ultimate demise of Blockbuster? In fact, Netflix isn't the firm that put the stake through Blockbuster's heart. It was Redbox. Why? Think about what Redbox did. They said, well, interestingly, if Blockbuster is really about new releases, we can do new releases more effectively, more cost efficiently than Blockbuster can. We don't need a giant brick and mortar store to give the customer new releases. We can do it with vending machines in supermarkets and convenience stores. So now Blockbuster was faced with Redbox, a pure play new release business with vending machines. Netflix offering old movies via online technology. What was Blockbuster now trying to do in the late 2000s? They were straddling. They were trying to brick and click, be online and in the stores, and could do neither as well as the two pure plays, Redbox and Netflix. So your assignment as we close this lecture, I want you to think about two interesting businesses facing some disruptive innovation today. Consider the hotel and the taxi businesses. What's changing about these businesses in the last few years? Let me give you a hint. Think about Uber and Airbnb. If you haven't heard of those firms, go ahead and Google them and learn a little bit about what Uber and Airbnb are doing, the hotel and the taxi businesses. And ask yourself, what makes these firms such an imposing threat to the incumbent players?
This lecture is titled, Anticipating Your Rival's Response.
In his great treatise on military strategy, Sun Tzu once wrote, "Know your enemy, know yourself, and you can fight 100 battles with no danger of defeat." When you are ignorant of the enemy, but know yourself, your chances of winning and losing are equal. If you don't know either your enemy or yourself, you are bound to perish in all battles, he wrote. Sun Tzu reminded us of the importance of analyzing your enemy, understanding your competitor. This is crucial in business as well as in the military. In this lecture, we'll try to understand competitive dynamics in more detail. We'll look at several situations where new entrants were doing battle with incumbents. We'll try to say, how might they have put themselves in the shoes of the incumbent player and tried to anticipate how that incumbent might respond to the entry of an entrepreneur into their market? This is what good firms do. They put themselves in the shoes of their rivals, and they try to anticipate how those competitors will react. And they use that information to help them plot a more effective strategy. Competitor analysis is a crucial tool for any strategist. There are three situations we'll look at in depth in this lecture. Three famous historical examples of competitive battles in the field of business. First, we'll look at the story of NutraSweet and their production of aspartame, an artificial sweetener. NutraSweet, the incumbent player with strong patents protecting their intellectual property in the 1980s. As the patents were set to expire, a new entrant emerged, Holland Sweetener Company, threatening their dominance. And we'll look at what happened. We'll also take a look at an Irish upstart airline called Ryanair that emerged in the late 1980s, entering into the market for the Dublin-London route for air travel. They competed against two dominant incumbent players, British Airways and Aer Lingus. And finally, we'll look again at Blockbuster, the incumbent player in the movie rental business, and how they dealt with an upstart called Netflix. Now, what's interesting about these three situations is that they're not all the same success story. Holland Sweetener faltered badly trying to unseat NutraSweet. Ryanair faltered badly at first, but then turned themselves around, adapted their strategy, and succeeded with flying colors. And finally, Netflix, we know, not only unseated Blockbuster, but drove Blockbuster to bankruptcy. Analyzing your competitor is a multifaceted task. It starts with looking at their past and their current strategy, understanding what they're trying to accomplish and how they're trying to position themselves in the marketplace. But it also means trying to understand their goals. What specific financial targets are they trying to achieve? What market share goals are they trying to achieve? How are they trying to advance the objectives of their shareholders, satisfy their customers more effectively, keep their employees motivated and engaged? But you also have to understand your competitors' capabilities and their weaknesses. What's world class about their production, their distribution, their research and development? And where do they lag behind? In what areas are they substandard? And finally, and perhaps most importantly, you really have to get inside the heads of the executives within that rival firm. You have to understand how they think. What motivates them? What is their background? Where did they come from educationally? What industries are they from? What prior companies did they work for? And how might that shape their experience? Where have they succeeded in the past? And where have they failed? Is there a certain formula that has worked for them in the past that they are likely to go to again in hopes of achieving another success? Anticipating the competitor's actions and their potential response to your actions means doing four things really well. First, it starts with understanding the economic and financial incentives of your competitors. That means taking a look at a particular action and trying to understand the costs and the benefits for your rival. So suppose that we thought about their action, taking in and engaging in a price war. What are the costs to the firm of doing that? How much might your rival's profits fall if they were to launch a price war? What benefits would accrue to them? Might they gain market share? How much market share and what kind of an increase in revenue and profit might they see by doing that? Understanding the costs and benefits of that particular action, a price war, is crucial to understanding how you might respond or deal with their efforts. But there's more than that. You can't just understand their economic incentives. You have to understand their non-economic motives. Beyond maximizing profits, what are the other goals that competitors are striving to achieve? Are they really focused on making themselves a more attractive workplace, trying to engage their employees more effectively? Are they trying to build market share now, perhaps forsaking profits in the short term to establish a more dominant position in the marketplace? Or are they dealing with intense pressures from Wall Street, and do they have to deliver quarterly earnings? And are they not able to take a hit now to build for the future? So understanding the non-economic motives of the competition, that's crucial. And that means understanding how they think. But we also have to understand the biases that may affect rivals' behavior. What do I mean by biases? Well, there's certain decision-making traps that we're all vulnerable to that may shape our decision-making. For example, we know that many of us, as individuals and as organizations, fall victim to something called the sunk cost trap. We have a hard time cutting our losses. If we put a lot into something, we tend to not want to walk away. So we end up escalating our commitment to courses of action, even if that course of action is failing. We throw good money after bad. What does this mean in terms of anticipating your competitors' actions and responses? Well, it means you may look at a situation and say, they really ought to exit that market. They really ought to shut down that product category. And we therefore are going to act in a certain way, knowing that we think they're going to exit. But they don't exit. That shouldn't surprise you. If you look more closely, you may realize they're really committed to that category. And they're going to have a hard time cutting our losses. Their bias is going to be to double down. Why? Because they're emotionally invested in that, not just financially invested in that. And so they'll have a hard time walking away. And if the product category is really tied to the history and legacy of their firm, all the more reason they may have a hard time walking away. So non-economic motives and biases cause them to stay in when you may initially have thought they were going to exit. Finally, you've already understood the financial incentives and the non-economic motives and the biases. Now you have to look at the broader context. What political factors may affect your rival's response? What contextual factors may shape their behavior? What do I mean by that? Well, let's think again about an anticipation of an exit from a particular product category. You may think your rival's going to get out of a certain segment of the market. But will they? Well, suppose your rival is based in France, not in the United States. Can they exit that easily? Well, the political context, right, may make it difficult to do so. In France, certain restrictions exist, so that it's much harder to downsize your firm, to close a factory, to lay off employees. Understanding that context may cause you to reevaluate your understanding of that rival. And you may say to yourself, they're going to stay in when initially, looking only at the numbers, I thought they would have gotten out. So understanding the context, where does national pride play? What does the history of the company tell us about how they might behave? What does the history of the individuals leading the firm tell us about how they might behave? Understanding these factors are all crucial if we're going to do a good competitor analysis and plot a more effective strategy as a result. Let's start by understanding the economic motives of our rivals. And here, game theory. A simple application of game theory can be helpful. Remember, in game theory, you're asking the question, what should I do? But first you're saying to yourself, let me think about what the opponent might do in various circumstances. Then, based on that prediction, let me figure out my strategy. So you're putting yourself in the rival's shoes, thinking about the different choices they have, trying to understand what they'll do, and then backing into what you might do, what's optimal for you, given your expectation of what they will do. Now, many people have looked at game theory and applied it to business in the simple scenario of an entrant, of an entrepreneur moving into a new market and confronting an incumbent player. The entrant is facing a simple choice. Do we move into this market or not? Do we go find another product market opportunity? The incumbent is also facing a choice. Do we fight? Do we retaliate? Do we aggressively respond to try to crush this entrepreneur and drive them out of the market? Do we protect our market share and our position fiercely? Or they could accommodate. What does accommodate mean? Accommodate doesn't mean that you're not at all trying to defend your position, but you're not as aggressive. You may even cede a small amount of market share in hopes of maintaining your current pricing, your current marketing spend, and the like. So you're not going to sacrifice a huge amount of profit to try to crush this rival today. You're going to be a little more accommodating to the new entrepreneur. So you face a choice. Fight hard or maybe less hard. The entrant, do I come in or do I not? Now you could imagine a scenario where you had a very small entrant, a new player coming in and likely only to take a very small slice of market share. If they look ahead and try to anticipate what the incumbent will do, well, if they're applying game theory, they might look and say, gosh, if the incumbent fights a price war to protect their market when we're so small, well, they may have to sacrifice huge amounts of profit by slicing their revenue dramatically to fight us. But they're only saving a small amount of market share. Perhaps it might be better for them to keep price where it is, to keep advertising right where it is, and to give us a little piece of the market. Maybe they'll be okay with that as long as it's not too big of a piece of the market. Maybe they won't retaliate that aggressively. If I know that as the entrant, I might be more likely to enter. If, on the other hand, I thought they were going to retaliate very aggressively, and I understood that that was their likely action, then I might look at my own profitability as an entrepreneur and say, I'm going to take a huge loss early on. I cannot afford to enter this market. The idea then in game theory is to look forward and reason back. Game theorists call this backward induction. You ask yourself, what will my rivals do in the future based on my actions now? And based on that answer, you decide what you will do today. Strategy ultimately is about anticipating competitor response whenever you make choices. And that's why game theory can be helpful. But game theory can also be limited. Why? Well, the real world isn't quite as simple as a game theory matrix or a decision tree. First and foremost, the real world is different because actors may not be completely rational. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that the opposing firm, the rival, they may not only care about maximizing economic profits. And in game theory, we typically think only in terms of the numbers at first. But to really understand your competitor, you have to go beyond that.